Hello, and welcome to episode 108 of the Awesome Comics Podcast, the place where small press comics make one hell of a big noise. I'm Vince Hunt, creator of the comic series The Red Mask from Mars, and joining me for today's jaunt into the light fantastic that is the world of comics is the man whose exploits no doubt inspired the term Klingon. It's Tony Esmond.
You right?
Yes.
Yeah. How and no Dan.
Dan Butcher couldn't be with us this week. Yeah. Very sad, but then again,
we're going to go and see Robocop.
Yeah, he's going to have a lovely day. And filling in for him this week are a couple of special guests. One of them a returning guest. We had the pleasure to chat to earlier, and it was epic.
We literally just said goodbye to them, didn't we? Both of them were superb. Yes. Absolutely brilliant.
So more on them in a moment. But first, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Comic House, for helping keep a roof over our heads. And Tony's fridge full of vegan quiches, fully stocked.
Viagra, what?
You love a vegan quiche, don't you? I bet.
Is Viagra vegan?
Well, probably. Helps with your protein. No, I'm not going there. Do you like quiches, Tony?
I do like quiche, yeah. I prefer to call it a flan, because I'm not part of the sort of, the middle class.
You buck the trend, don't you? To call it a quiche isn't middle class.
It is. It's a flan.
A flan? Oh, I always consider a flan to be like a sweet thing rather than a savoury. That's just me. Anyway, Comic House is... Other pastries are available. Comic House is the place where creators can buy and sell their comic books online. And publishers and indie creators can list their stuff for free. And on the website, you'll see all kinds of amazing indie titles. And also some bigger name ones to boot, if that's your bag. There's some Judge Dredd and 2000 AD stuff, which is quite fitting, considering this week's guest. So it's well worth checking out if you want to help support those indie creators you might not be able to see at conventions. Which is great, because money actually goes back to the creators. Plus, they publish a badass anthology series, which is jam-packed with indie talent. And not only that, they're launching an app that is essentially Netflix for comics. So sort yourself out and get on board, people. Sign up and find out more about the app itself at comichouse.com/app. And check
out...
Tony doesn't sign up for anything, so that's...
I don't give a fuck about anything, but I've done that one.
Yeah, because it's going to be awesome. And to check out the awesome stuff that they've got elsewhere, go to comichouse.com. Thank you very much. Anyway, cool. We've got an epic one for you this week, folks. And it's epically brilliant.
I hope you've got a long car journey, because not only have we got a brilliant episode, we've got some more coming after it as well. So there you go.
Yeah, there you go. Yes, we had a chance to once again talk to the mighty Pat Mills this week. He very kindly joined us. And Lisa Mills, who was...
a little surprise guest.
Yes, who was an absolute legend. So should we just, rather than give a large intro to this chat, should we just get stuck into it?
Doesn't need an intro, does it, these guys?
It doesn't need an intro. Here you go, folks. Enjoy probably 2 hours of some of the finest chat you'll hear all week. Here you go. Okay, well, our triumphant returning guest needs no introduction, but by gum, he's getting one anyway. He's the man behind such characters as Slane, Nemesis the Warlock, Martial Law, Defoe, to name but a few. The list could be massive, couldn't it, Tony? Let's be honest. He's also responsible for the mighty 2000 AD. If that wasn't enough, he's now taking over the world of prose with the book Serial Killer, Read 'Em and Weep, and the new Kick-Ass and Take Names non-fiction book, and it is Kick-Ass and Take Names. Be Pure, Be Vigilant, Behave, 2000 AD and Judge Dredd, A Secret History. That was the full title, isn't it, Tony?
Well done.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
That's right, it's our pleasure to welcome back the one and only Pat Mills to the show.
Hey, Pat.
Hi, guys. Thanks for that.
And I understand that somewhere in the background is the equally mighty Lisa Mills. Are you there, Lise?
I am here. Can you hear me? I'm a little further back. Yeah, I will lean in further if you need me. But I mean, Pat's really the star here, so I'm gonna stay quiet in the background unless you start bullying me.
Is that an exclusive first appearance of Lisa as a
proper? It is. On the banner.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah. Should we just kick off, Pat? Well, what I'd quite like to do is ask you what prompted you to write The Secret History.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's the 40th and everything, but is there anything else that sort of kick-started? I know you'd put it on the blog, but it's a lot more than what was on the blog, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm trying to think what that was all about, really. I suppose it was the 40th that did kick it off. You know, and I think maybe the realization that there's a kind of public facade of what 2000 AD represents, and then there's the reality, which is rather different.
Yeah.
And I suppose I'd always rather hope that, somebody else might pick up the baton bring into the public arena a lot of things that I think concern many creators. And right. As nobody else seemed to be doing that, I thought, oh, shit, maybe it's got to be me. And once having done that, it's a fairly cathartic experience. Not completely, yeah. Because it would be... when you read the book, you'll see that the ending isn't as happy as one would like it to be. But at the same time, it's like going through. I think I wrote it over a couple of months or so, and it's like going through your whole life, in 2 months. You imagine either of you if you guys are doing that, and it leaves you at the end of it all thinking, yeah. So what was all that about? And inevitably, as with all of us, you have that sort of feeling of, well, what if we'd done it this way, or what if that had happened? And so there's a certain amount of what if.
Yeah.
I think it's a valuable experience, and I think from the reader's point of view, guys such as yourselves. It gives you the information to answer all those, to get to the bottom of any number of things where you're thinking, why did that happen and why did this happen? And I think it gives everyone an insight into what really went on.
Good, because I suppose people like to rewrite history, don't they? And I know we've talked about it in respects to actual sort of wartime history and stuff, but certain rewrites happen, and I think unless you get in there and you say, like, this is what actually happened, then there is the chance that certain thing parts of it get a little tweak here and there, don't they,
Yeah, and actually, as I was writing it, I just thought, maybe there was an explanation for this or an explanation for that, and then when you actually get into it, you realize no, actually, it's much worse than I thought. a good example of this is this myth that at least two Thargs, three Thargs I can think of, actively promote that the reason we, generally speaking, don't have young readers anymore is because of changing demographics and computer tastes and all the rest of it. And, I'd always known that was worth challenging, but I think the book makes it very clear. I'm not going to put a gloss on this. It's a fucking lie.
Right.
We lost the readers because the Thargs wanted to pursue an adult audience because, for various reasons, because it's better for their egos and everything else. And then, of course, when kids feel alienated, you can quite comfortably sit back and say, they're not interested in this kind of thing anymore. You know, they're into computer games. But, it is quite outrageous.
Yeah.
It's really not uncommon in publishing. It's a kind of, particularly, I guess, within comics, a kind of elitism, a kind of snobbery. I'll give you one example, for instance. Back in the day, if someone had, let's say, a relative hit on Vertigo, that be, say, 20,000, something like that, right?
Yeah.
You know, the fan press would be full of it. Now, something like Punisher 2099, which sold a million copies, you'd never hear about.
Yeah.
And that's fair enough, because... you know, if you like, the more eclectic tastes are represented in the fan press. But at the end of the day, you need those million kids out there for whatever.
Yeah, you do.
Unlikely reason they want to read Punisher 2099. I mean, some of them bought it as a collector's item, which, of course, they're going to be bitterly disappointed on. There's another million.
What
of
do you mean?
There.
I've still got mine unopened in a bag.
Well, I think that's what quite a lot of them have as well. But the point is, we're neglecting those kids, and and it's a great shame. And it seems a uniquely British thing to do that. And I have this vague theory that it follows in a long line of British screw-ups. You know, whether in the past it was more indifference to the audience, or in this case, playing to a more sophisticated gallery, whatever it is, it's something in our British psyche, and I feel sad about that, you know?
Yeah. Do you think there's a lack of investment? You know, you can tell the people in any kind of job who are like full on invested in that job, you know, and they spend a lot of their private life, you know, thinking and talking and working on it. Do you think it's become a day job in some of British comics marketing and stuff like that?
I think not so much with the current regime, Rebellion. Right. I think all those guys, in one way or another, I think they do love 2000 AD and what it represents. Good. I think there's a genuine enthusiasm, and it wouldn't surprise me if they're not unlike Games Workshop in that respect, where I think we probably all know that guys on Games Workshop, at least in the past, would live and breathe the product. But I think in the case of Rebellion, they've inherited a product where the damage had already been done, and they've done more than make the best of it. They've revitalized it, but still within the what you might call the perimeters of and on a certain level, you might say it makes sense. I mean, who's their audience? Mainly guys middle-aged, perhaps, who've grown up reading 2000 AD. A small percentage of newcomers, a small percentage of Americans, perhaps, and so on. But, you know, they're feeding their core audience, and that's totally understandable that they would do that. But at the same time, it's a great shame that that previous huge audience we had has been so, you know, still isn't catered for. And I think everyone's just said, with some validity, I don't know if they would actually say this, because I think it's much more comfortable to say, oh, well, they're into computer games now.
Right.
What can we do? But the other reality, which I cover in some detail in Be Pure, is they're tough to work for. I mean, I think you and I have talked about this, Tony, that, you know, their requirements are the same as yours and mine and so on, but with some significant and subtle differences. And that actually varies even from, say, an age group like, say, 8 to 12, and then you go 12 to 14, then you go 14 to 16, and there will be changes within those. And in the past, I mean, when we were doing 2000 AD and other comics, we were aware of that, and we more or less knew, perhaps on not so much an intuitive level, but simply because we studied reader feedback in such comprehensive detail, so we knew, this story works. And after a while, even if you're not very bright, you can go, well, that works because it's got lots of big guns in it. You know?
I know you mentioned that a lot in the book, Pat, don't you? You mentioned that feedback was like hugely important to 2000 AD in the early days, even to the point where you would examine it. I think you say if you've got the name of the central character in the title, it works better, it even sells better. It was even examined like that, was it?
Yeah, I mean, that's one that I think has kind of been ignored over the years. And I think even at the time, it was something that we were only vaguely aware of. And I think I became fully aware of it with Misty, and it's a harsh rule, and it's a rule that I'm sure some of your listeners, you know, tuning into this will object to, as will I, but it is true. I mean, okay, I'll give you an example. On Misty, right, I wrote Moonchild, and because the heroine's name is in the title, that was one of the reasons why it was the number one story. Now, Malcolm Shaw wrote a really good story called The Sentinels, which is about a Nazi alternative Earth, and which I think many many guys who read their sister's Misty may even like more. And that actually tells you a lot, because it's the concept. So what happens is, especially for guys in particular, the concept is often more interesting than the central character.
Okay.
But if you focus on the central character, particularly for young women, they will follow that. And so it kind of channels their energy. And it would happen time and time again on girls' comics. And for whatever reason, I suppose I probably spent more time thinking about this and interpreting it than maybe others. Perhaps because when I was doing 2000 AD, I really had to get it right. But even there, as someone will be quick to point out, on Flesh is a great title, but it doesn't have the monster's name in the title or the humans who are hunting the monster.
Yeah.
And you know, it unfortunately, I have to say, it proves my point, because Flesh was very successful, but it was never a number one story, whereas Mac 1 was. Slain was, Judge Dredd is, and you've only got to look at Batman and Superman to see how true that is. And it's one of these rules that I sort of think, God, I'd better really broadcast this, because I could actually, save someone wasting their time. But I think we all sort of think, well, no, it's different with science fiction. No, it isn't. And they say, what about movies? Different rules.
Okay.
Have the hero's name in the title.
Interesting. Yeah, that is, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you really had to sort of raid the grey matter for this book, did you, Pat? Or do you keep stuff as the years go on? But do you keep a diary, or do you keep fans' letters?
Yeah,
or,
I was wondering.
You know, replies or stuff like that.
I keep a number of readers' letters, particularly pertaining to. The ones that said, and I quoted, I quote one in the book, and it really, and I really grimaced when I reread it and put it up in the book, where he said, you know, I love 2000 AD. I read it for a long, long while. Then I got to Halo Jones and I didn't really understand Halo Jones. And then other stories came in And I realized at the age of 19 that I wasn't cool enough for 2000 AD.
Oh, wow,
so I left. And I thought, oh, my God. And, you know, that isn't just one guy letting off steam there. You know, I got several like that. So, yeah, I do keep those kind of letters, because those letters of complaint will largely be ignored today, because we, you know... But they're important, because they provide, if you like, a minority report on what happened to 2000 AD. Aside from those, for the most part, I think the memories are really scarred into my brain, which is surprising, because in some other respects, I have a really crap memory. But now I can remember all these details. And Kevin O'Neill, I think, on occasion... has supplemented some of my memories with some of his own. And, so yeah, we've got a fairly detailed picture on the past.
Yeah, definitely. Did you run much of it past any other creators like John Wagner or Alan Grant or Carlos? Because I know I think Carlos is almost a neighbour of yours out there, isn't he? He lives.
And I keep meaning to meet up with him, and he actually dropped me a line a few days ago and said how much he liked the book. And
oh, brilliant.
He was talking about And there's a thing that I probably need to amend, or I need to go back and look at exactly what I said and maybe make a little clearer.
Yeah.
That on page one of the first Judge Dredd that appeared, you know, I'm talking about it being Mike McMahon. But of course, in these days where before creators' sensibilities were considered, it has Carlos's image at the top, followed by Mike McMahon's artwork. You know,
In fact,
it's a patchwork. I mean, this kind of thing was not unusual in those days. You know, it's all part of the nature of British comics. I may look back on that and modify it in a later edition. And if there are other creators who, challenge some of the things I've said and say, I'll happily amend. The digital book has been out for some weeks, and there hasn't been any feedback as regards that. So
hugely positive, the feedback, Pat, isn't it? From what I can see, it was much needed. It was a book that 2000 AD fans are crazy keen on their comic, aren't they? You know, they must be loving this.
Yeah, I think there's things that needed to be said, and not everyone will agree with everything, and I welcome all alternative perspectives, because this is just my point of view. But I think one of the things that needed to be said is a kind of a gorilla in the corner that fans are kind of aware of, and I don't think there was a kind of recognized vocabulary for it, which I like to think the book has put right, which is the idea that there are creators and there are developers.
Yeah.
Now, we all know that on 2000 AD, in many instances, it's the developers who have actually often made a character even more successful than the original creators. And that's absolutely fine. But of course, it does raise the issue of should the developers, on occasion, be rewarded. In other words, a classic example, I think, which is one where I think I can be, quite neutral on, or relatively neutral, would be Slane. Where, for example, supposing there was a Slane movie, which could well, would probably draw on the work of Simon Bisley, rather than anyone else who had gone before him. And, to say, well, he's just the developer, tough luck, I don't think the fans would wear that. I wouldn't have thought so. It's looking ahead to future times and saying, well, here's a way of looking at it. And it's no good the suit saying, oh, well, nothing can be done. That's nonsense. It can be done. There's a really simple rule on these things where you just take the French model, and where a developer does things, they get rewarded in a certain percentage or figures. It's not rocket science. The important thing is it can be done if people want to do it. If they don't, they'll just hide behind excuses. So I hope that never happens. I mean, at the moment, that's just a gleam in my eye, the thought of a Slane movie. But we do get a lot of interest in Slane, so sooner or later,
so good.
It also comes down to recognition as well, isn't it? I mean, if you're a sort of developer, and you've written or drawn and created a story that has been adapted into a film, you see some of these big films, and they always credit the people that have created the characters way back in the 60s or the 50s or whatever, but they'll be using a more modern story. And if you don't name check in some way the person that's been responsible for that, people pick up on it, don't they?
And they do. They do.
I think so. I mean, Frank Miller's the one of the best examples, isn't it? I mean, I'm not up to speed entirely on Batman, but my sense is that most of the modern day Batman in every media form owes everything to Frank.
Yeah, there's a big shout out to Frank, isn't there? Definitely.
Yeah.
And Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams, you know, these guys as well.
Yeah.
You know, hugely. I know, because, for example, you pretty much, you developed, say, for example, is it Harlem Heroes, and then you handed it over? Stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know. So you came up, you talk a lot about that, don't you, Pat? You know.
Yeah, the Harlem Heroes, I think... I had to actually remind Rebellion that I have actually, kick the character off.
Yeah.
But I mean, I suppose I don't feel quite as protective about that one as perhaps some other stories, because, see, that was one of those stories. It was one of the ways we all kind of survived economically in male comics, really, was by what I would call a formula approach, namely... one story is successful, so you produce something like it. So Action had produced Death Game 1999, which was a wonderful story. I mean,
definitely.
And, much credit goes to, my editor on Action, Jeff Kemp, when we dreamed that up, and Tom Tully and the various artists, including Ballardinelli, I think. But I mean, that was fantastic. So, Harlem Heroes comes along, and it's following in the same style. So that makes it actually easier to create.
Okay.
The problem, of course, comes when you create something from cold in a new genre of science fiction or fantasy. I mean, that's when it gets tough, and that's the bit that I think has largely been neglected. Well, it has been entirely neglected in recent. In recent years, in the Rebellion years. So the net result is, you think, well, I estimate it takes up to 6 weeks to create an entirely new kind of story. Let's say, for example, I thought, okay, I'm going to create a new space opera, which might have something in common with Star Trek, Dan Dare, The Expanse, you name it. And now, to create something like that entirely cold, it's got to take at least... I was trying to think in minimal figures. It would take me 6 weeks to do. And I think it would take any other writer the same, because particularly on a space opera like that, you've got to have a lot of liaison with the artist, haven't you? In other words, what's the look of the thing? What are they going to look like? What's the spaceship's going to look like? Because the spaceship often is it's a character in its own right.
Yeah, it's very iconic, isn't it?
So, I mean, if I was to say to Matt, I'd love to do a space opera, how do you feel about it? I think there's a reasonable chance he might jump at the idea. But then if I said to him, can you pay me 6 weeks development time, which is hardly a fortune... I think that would be the end of the matter, shall we say. And so as a result, what you have is you don't have that many, I'm not aware of that many iconic new characters. In other words, so we tend to, stay with the classic characters. And this was a huge criticism by the readers, in the 80s, who were still often quite juvenile and quite unrealistic in their demands. Hey, okay, you thought up Slay, now think up something else. Yeah, right. And, we like Robusters, but I'm getting a bit bored with it. Can't you come up with another new robot story? Yeah. And the answer is, of course, if you're being paid development time, you can.
Yeah.
I think half the purpose of the book is to actually establish a lexicon on this, to say, well, this is how it works. So if someone wanted a new story, this is the reality. Because if you sell all rights to the publisher, which is the sad circumstances that we face in British comics, you're actually doing six weeks unpaid work for the publisher. You're subsidizing his character because you don't own it. He owns it, and I think that needs highlighting, so that that people know what it's about. I mean, particularly if there's some, what should we say, there's some, a new Simon Bisley out there who's thinking of, oh, maybe I should go and work for 2000 AD, you know, at least know what you're letting yourself in for.
Yeah. I think you don't just sit down and type, do you? People think, oh, I'll write a story. You don't just walk in and sit and start typing, do you? Yeah, that's
no.
That's just
no. I mean, there's a lot of. I mean, one of the examples I gave in the book, and I think it's a really good one, is, and it, in fact, it might even have been longer than a week. But I know, as a writer, I would only admit to it taking a week. John Wagner, when he did Strontium Dog, he needed a, obviously, you know, he came up with a title. And my recollection is that he disappeared for a week because he used to live near me. And my recollection is he disappeared for a week to come up with that title. And it's one of the best titles, if not the best in 2000 AD. It's a brilliant title, but it took him a week. Now, I can't imagine what he was doing there, you know, staring out the window, going for long walks, you know, having a drink down the local pub. Who knows? But, I mean, it took him a week. Now, if you said to a publisher like Rebellion today, or and can I have another week to come up with a title for a new Star Trek story, they'd just say, get knotted. And, of course, at the time, when John came up with that title, he wasn't paid extra for that. That it was just he was meant to absorb the cost of that through subsequently writing Strontium Dog. Now, probably at that time, it was probably just about economically viable. Previously, we were in sweatshop circumstances, and they got better under 2000 AD and Star-Lord, because what I did... we had 3-page stories, which were, you know, I mean, you're talking about half a novel in 3 pages. And if you go back to any of those comics, you'll see what I mean. So by making the story 6 pages, it meant, in effect, everyone was getting double the money. So that would have helped John at the time. But, of course, I think you and I have talked about this. Probably there might be a case for even longer stories now because people get in, you know. So in a way, I have an uneasy feeling. I don't know, but I have an uneasy feeling that, the way that we would all look on Hotspur stories and say, well, sometimes they're great stories, but my God, there's 8 pictures on a page and there's only 3 pages of it, you know, or even, actually, I think it was more. I think it was 28 pictures over 3 pages, I think, was the norm in British comics. Now, it's certainly on girls' comics, and then on Valiant, I think it was 7 pictures on a page, which is sort of okay, I suppose. But then you have these tiny stories. I think one of the things I think I was trying to identify a little desperately, I have to be honest, I was thinking, how could they do it in a way that would work for everyone concerned? And there are answers, but... I fear the usual answer is just keep going as things are. And that's a fair enough strategy. But the problem with it is that when things are not right, it can often, by the time it filters through into the reader's consciousness or, into the circulation of the comic, you know, it can take 2 or 3 years and then suddenly you find people are walking away from things, and I think there's always that fear for me. I think, for instance, in the book, I'm quite damning about the late 90s, but of course the seeds were sown in the early 90s. You know, the trend towards certain directions, and so by the time the readers get to 1995, 1996, it's at that point they say, you know what? I don't like this comic anymore. I'm not buying it. And that's when they all started to leave in droves. It probably took something like, I don't know, Space Girls or something to push them over the edge. But, I don't know. You see, I don't know, in some ways I feel quite arcane and quite peculiar on this, because for me, when I, you know, when we were producing comics, it was really normal to study the reader feedback on everything in really precise detail. You know, yeah. it was so normal, even to the extent where you could be in the middle of a serial and the editor would ring you up and say, actually, it's not going down very well. Kill it.
But that,
and
people
I give
don't
an example of that in the book.
Yeah, people don't appreciate that. For those that aren't quite as old as we are, you used to actually get a bit you could cut out and send in, didn't you, where you would put your top stories? Yeah. And you guys paid a lot of attention to that, didn't you?
A huge amount. I mean, it was life or death for individual creators and comics. I mean, it sounds awful now, the idea of cutting up your comic. You know, this is a comic that you actually love in the first place. You know, whether you're a fan, a collector, or just the kid in the street. I mean, you still love that comic, and you're being encouraged to cut it up. which does sound awful now, doesn't it? I mean, of course, what a lot of them would do, they wouldn't do that. They're obviously more sensible than we were, because what they would do is they would write in and they would list in their letter, my number one story is, let's say, Judge Dredd, and the story I like least, and that would be included as well. So there was ammunition. And it might well be Ant Wars or something, you know.
Yeah.
And so you really got this perspective on things. And I have to be honest, again, we would often curse the readers, because the stories that were invariably the most popular were the all-action stories. And so the stories that, you know, probably today a lot of us would say, oh, that was a great episode, like, say, Nemesis Great Uncle Bar, where, you know, they're standing around chatting. I mean, you know, that stiffed at the box office, or with the book charts. Time, the art editor on 2000 AD rang us up with great pleasure to tell us that, you know, it had sunk in the popularity polls. You know, sort of there's this kind of them and us attitude between staff and creators, and it could be tough. And I remember John Wagner, when he wrote Darkie's Mob, I mean, some of the episodes were very strong psychologically and emotionally. And I remember him being, you know, quite depressed that the ones they really like is just where Joe Darkie is running around with a submachine gun blasting the Japanese, you know. so there's almost a feeling of, oh, for God's sake, what's the point? I think it's possible to get past that. I think we're all that much more sophisticated, and we wouldn't allow a one episode scene setting episode to get in the way. But at the same time, it is an art form to continually sustain action, conversation, characterization. I mean, it would drive Americans mad. You think they got, what, 21 pages to develop their plots, and, you know, we have to have beginning, middle, and an end, six pages.
Yeah, it's tough. I have to say, that's one of my favourite bits of the book, Pat, is you go through each character, and you spend an awful lot of time on the creation of Judge Dredd, actually, and there's loads of stuff in there I didn't know about how he came about. So you almost, like, systematically go through the bigger characters that you've been involved in, don't you, especially at the start there. And so this is why, this is how it happened, this is why it changed, this is how the creative team changed a little bit on it occasionally, stuff like that. Very interesting stuff, really, really good. You know, is there any other characters you want to speak to? Yeah, go on, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I spent a lot of time on Judge Dredd, and of course, you know, it was the first time in a very long while, because it's been ages since I've written Dredd, and it's the first time I actually sort of stepped back and thought about it, and two things I highlight in the story of the creation of Dredd, and I think it's two tricks we've missed. And one of them I highlight is Carlos's original city has a sense of mystery about it. That first view of it is mysterious. Now, right. Megacity as it stands today, or as most artists have drawn it, is beautiful, it's fantastic, and so on. But I don't think anyone would say it was mysterious. You know, whereas Carlos's original vision is mysterious and almost alien. You know, you have these beetle-like tops to their starscrapers, and they're incredibly thin. They're not functional. You know, they only look you know, like a couple of apartments wide almost. You know, they're skeletal almost, and so there's that whole sense of mystery there, which, I mean, you know, it's kind of been neglected. And then the other thing, which I think has been overlooked, and I doubt anything will be done about it, because it's just safer to stay inside the tram lines, which I think is a shame, and that is the sense of dread when you see Judge Dredd. Now,
okay.
To create dread in any... I mean, the best example, perhaps, of a sense of dread would be Nosferatu. I mean, you see him walking up the stairs, and you're thinking, oh, my God, what is he going to do, you know? And that was always there. I mean, it's in the very title, Judge Dredd. And I think that sense of noir-like fear and anticipation and so on, I think we've missed a trick there as well.
Okay.
And as I say in the book, that's, I think, essentially my bad, because, you know, whatever you set up at the beginning, you're probably going to be stuck with forever, and good and bad. You know, the foundations of a story are always going to haunt you, so you've got to get it right at the beginning. And so if you look at, say, the first episode of Judge Dredd, that with all the whole infrastructure of the judges is all there in episode one, largely down to Peter Harris, who I described came up with this incredible one-off Dredd story that really set up the world. So, you know, that's how it started, and that's how, to a large extent, it still is today. But if you have that sense of dread, the challenge is it eats up so many pages. You know, if you really want to have someone creeping up the stairs as drawn by, let's say, David Lloyd or Steranko, you don't want it to just be a couple of pictures and then you're slam bang into the action. You really want to linger on it and... you know, the doors creaking or whatever it is. And so, I don't know, it was interesting how these new things came to light in the course of writing the book. And I don't know, I hope it'll encourage maybe other creators to come up with, you know, their thoughts on this era or later. And indeed the readers as well. There may be, you know, they may have insights that we've all missed.
Yeah. I mean, that was what I was going to move on to, Pat, is the sort of the 70s was an era of some just amazing creativity, you know, in every sort of medium, really. Did you do you think that was due to a sort of overbearing political climate? Do you think it was you were almost the underdog creating art? Do you think there was a bit of that somehow?
I mean, I suppose, I mean, what we were doing on 2000 AD and other British comics was happening just about everywhere else in the media.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm not quite sure why it was happening. I mean, it's certainly happening if you look at movies as Dirty Harry and all those kind of things, which were reacting against the conventions of before. There was definitely a sense of rebellion in the air. And
In music especially as well, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, music. You had things like New English Library that was producing books like the Sven Hassel series, there were skinhead novels and all these kind of things, which would have been unheard of before. And so probably all creators generally tend to write about things when they're feeling angry. But I think there was more anger than ever. it would be hard to, and of course it applied to television as well. I mean, a lot of TV dramas aimed at kids, I'm not so sure that they could be shown today in their original form. You know, it's really pushing the boundaries, and there was almost a sense of how far can we go? And of course we found out in the case of Action, thus far and no further. And even where 2000 AD was concerned, that it was thus far and no further. So exciting times.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I often look back on that, and if you look at American comics as well, the Bronze Age there, they were really sort of twisting ideas and coming up with sort of quite sort of trippy kind of stuff. You know, there was the real counterculture seems to have spilled over from the 60s into the 70s, but given a sort of almost like a harder edge to it somehow. You know,
I think that's a very good summary, and we were influenced by those kind of stories that you're describing. I think comes to mind, wasn't there some kind of Martian War of the Worlds story? Paul Gulacy, was it?
Gulacy and McGregor, yeah, it's incredible stuff.
Now, I mean, I think that was certainly an influence on me, and another one would be Deathlok the Demolisher.
Yes,
Where he has this computer in his brain. And so we did something similar with Mac One. And those stories were really quite powerful. And I don't know. I mean, you tell me, but I get the feeling that they've left the Marvel and DC mainstream, those kind of stories.
I think you're right. I mean, I was going to mention earlier, because Jim Lee has been quite vocal this week about, because it's San Diego this weekend for anyone that's listening. Has been quite vocal about saying that there is problems in the comic industry in America as well. You know, sales are down. They need to do something, you know. And that might be the reason. The homogenization of, you know, the movies drip feeding back into the comics, because the movies are made to be very popular, aren't they? They're cutting on that popular edge, and the drip feed back into the comics may be causing us problems where people go to comics to read something that is a little bit edgy and a little bit different and a little bit out there, maybe, you know.
I think again, that's a good summary, and right. Something I didn't quite summarize this succinctly in the book, but I think what it comes down to is in all publishing on both sides of the Atlantic, and I have to be fair that the French are no different. They have their own problems as well, although with a particularly Gallic spin to it. But, you know, at the end of the day, it always seems to come down to a battle between the suits and the creatives. That's what it's always about. And I think when the suits become too powerful, and I think that's happening both in the UK and the US, the creativity gets crushed, and that has a knock-on effect on sales. Now, often, as I say, it's like a ship turning. It takes a while for it to take effect. So it can be 2 years down the line. So the suits can say, well, it's not because of this guy. It's just changing demographics or whatever. Any other excuse they want to come up with. But it is inevitably, it is that battle. So in the US, where everything is presumably now very carefully marketed, and, you know, everyone's like, right, well, if we do this Batman story, how does that tie in? So it's all scientific rather than creative. Yeah. And you know, the natural tendency with creatives is to take a chance and to take a gamble sometimes and say, okay, let's go out on a limb and let's do this or that. And I think the natural tendency of suits is to be incredibly cautious. And I think back in the 70s and 80s, right through perhaps into the early 90s, creators had a lot more freedom. You could almost do anything you wanted within reason. You know, you could go out on a limb and say, right, well, 2000 AD is a science fiction comic, but I'm going to do a barbarian hero. If someone was to say that today, the suits would say no. And if an artist, I think another good example of this is, if an artist like Kevin O'Neill, if he came along tomorrow with his, you know, extremely different style,
Yeah.
The suits wouldn't let him in. There's no way the suits would let him in. They'd say, no, no, you've got to draw like, you know, Brian Bolland or,
yeah.
or you know, whoever is the icon around at the time. And the proof of that is you go back to Valiant and there were all these guys who were either imitating Lopez or other artists. They're all copying each other because the people in charge, they're just not prepared to let in new talent. So, you know, this is an era where I believe I'm right in saying Barry Windsor-Smith, I think, goes back to that Valiant era. And I believe I'm right in saying he couldn't get into Fleetway, so went to America and is one of their premier artists.
Yeah, yeah. Really,
I mean,
is.
People make a name by doing something different. You know, you rarely make a name by doing something that's been done for the past 10 years. It's always when someone new comes in and creates something fresh, whether that be a story or artwork, they're always the people that then, you know, they immediately shoot to the top of the list, don't they, really?
And they stay there as well, you know. Yeah, yeah, I think they do.
But then you're in the danger.
Yeah, it's that taking that risk. Yeah. And an example I give, and it's happened. She's been turned down often enough now for me to believe there is something behind it. Is Faye Dalton? I mentioned in the book. Now it's not that I don't think her work is actually that different. It's beautiful, it's sexy, it's a little retro in a kind of Mad Men style.
Yeah.
But I haven't been able to get her into 2000 AD, whereas, say, a decade or two earlier, it would have been a walk in the park. It would have been so easy to have gotten her in. And now it's just not possible. And I recognized her work instantly as being, you know, in the tradition of all those innovative artists that have come into 2000 AD, like Bisley, Jock, Kevin O'Neill, and so forth. I thought, wow, this is someone, she's really saying something. And I think what happens is, it's the soup thinking again. You go for the safe option and, you know, it's often the case when characters become really important, you know, where they're monetized in merchandising and so on. I can remember my first wife drawing Captain, is it Klepp? Was it Captain? No, yes. Captain Kremen.
Okay.
Yeah. And everything had to be exact. It had to be, he could only have, well, let's say three buttons and the shoes had to be the right color and everything, and so the whole thing becomes so burdensome. You know, there's no room for, you know, that kind of an ad lib approach. Once again, could you imagine someone like Mike McMahon coming in tomorrow to 2000 AD and suddenly he's drawing everyone with big feet and they've all got that kind of slightly hairy scowly look? You know, it would be hard for someone like that to be taken on board. I should say, and I have no evidence for this one way or the other. I don't know what your thoughts are. I wonder whether kids, a younger audience, are more open to new possibilities than, you know, as you've become middle aged and you know, you've grown up with Bolland and McMahon and O'Neill and so on. So if someone new comes along, would there be the same, you know, open embrace of it? I don't know.
No, I'm not sure. That's a difficult one because our community is so much older now, isn't it? You know, comic readers are much more prepared to take a chance.
I like to think that they, if it was someone as kind of very accessible, like Jock, I'm sure a new Jock would be instantly, you know, embraced by the comic audience. But if it was someone as left field as say Kevin or perhaps Faye Dalton, maybe there would be some resistance. I don't know.
Yeah, I was actually thinking of Olivier Ledroit. Is it Ledroit? Is that how you say it?
Yeah, Ledroit. Yeah,
Ledroit. Yeah, and I was thinking he's got a very strange style. He's very good, but strange. You know.
I think with a younger audience, it can come down to the character. I think if you try to draw a new audience in They're leaning in towards the character, and I think, I actually think they're liable to go. They'll go along with the art style if the character's appealing to them. That's what I think.
I think that's a very good point, and you're right. That's another layer that I've omitted to mention. But you're absolutely right. If the character is very accessible, then an audience will go with it. And of course, if the artist in question is a good storyteller, so in the case of Olivier Ledoire, he's generally speaking a very good storyteller. Although there is something very French about each page, which means that a British audience has to make a slight adjustment, a slight mental adjustment to, you know, okay, there's a lot of detail here. And you sometimes do need sunglasses to
look at. Fuck me, he's got a lot of detail. He really has. I mean, I read it, and I've got the paper copies, but I think this would be a perfect book for guided view, because talking about panel numbers on a page, sometimes he's got like 10 panels on a page, and all of them to a panel could be a whole page. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? They're just so
thick. I know, and to see that on a large screen is quite an experience. In fact, Lisa's just been lettering Requiem 11,
cool.
You know, the very latest one, which has never seen life in paper form before. So she's actually quite qualified to. What was your experience on that one?
It's always absolutely fantastic fun looking at Olivia's work and preparing it for Comixology. So it's been absolutely wonderful. I haven't been doing the original lettering. I just want to say that, because Jacques Collin is the original letterer. What I've been doing is taking the French and then just kind of using Pat's original script, and putting that script into the speech balloons, which, you know, it takes a bit of adjusting, and sometimes, like, the French is longer or shorter than the original, so kind of playing around with it. But it's so lovely looking up close at Olivia's work on a screen, because when it's backlit, the detail and the colours really, really shine through, which you don't. I'm not sure that the Panini edition really kind of brings the artwork out to its best, because it's
sort of dulls it a tiny bit.
And also sometimes printing can darken things. You know?
Definitely.
And also he does a lot of spreads, so if you have quite tight binding, then you lose some of that. And to be fair, even some of the French albums have a little bit of a problem there as well. So being able to actually see the spread in its entirety on a screen, is just really exciting. So that's been really great. And I'm hoping to get that up. I keep putting it back, actually, because there's so much going on. But don't want to be called a liar here. I might get 11 up by the end of next week.
Brilliant.
And then, obviously, Comixology has to process that, because they do all the guided view.
Yeah.
And then they'll schedule that. Let me see. I know that volume 10 is actually coming out. I think it's the 2nd of August, if that's a Wednesday, because the creator submitted work comes out on a Wednesday.
Yeah.
So it could be the following week or a couple of weeks later. But what we're also considering doing is actually putting 11 up on our own Gumroad store.
Okay.
Because it's a little bit special, because it hasn't been released in the English language, as Pat said, there's actually quite a lot of fans who have been waiting patiently for years to actually read volume 11. Right. You know, they've already perhaps seen the Panini ones, or they may have even gone back as early as the heavy metal stuff. And so they're really excited at the fact that 11 is coming out finally. And so I might skip ahead, because I was putting Requiem up on Gumroad, but it is a little labour intensive, and it's actually, funnily enough, easier to go straight for Comixology. But I think 11 is a special case.
Just
because I kind of convert it to CBZ and, you know, just kind of fiddle around with it a little bit more.
They're highly recommended. I absolutely love them. They're just the most beautiful books, aren't they, as well, you know?
Yeah, incredible really stuff. So. And you can really linger over them, you know. I mean, obviously the story is really detailed and multi-layered, and it's a very complex story.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
And the art that, so you know, I think you do get a lot of bang for your buck.
While you're on, Lise, you obviously going back to the prose novels you're doing. Was it your idea to put them on Amazon, or how did that come about?
So which ones are we talking about?
Read 'em and Weep, and then
Read 'em and Weep. I think it was something we came to together, really, wasn't it? It was quite a long time ago. I mean, when did we start talking about publishing Read 'em and Weep as a text novel? That would have been late 2014, early 2015. Okay. We were talking about this. I think, I mean, as indie publishing has grown and it's become easier, it was just the obvious choice, really. And I think we had quite a lot of, what should we say, a few setbacks, a few disappointments with trying to get things published through traditional publishers. We're talking, comic book stories, and we were just kind of being thwarted quite a lot. And when Comixology opened its creator submissions program, that was hugely exciting.
Yeah.
Suddenly we weren't being held back in that area, and we have, you know, other plans there. And so when we were looking at, okay, what do we actually have? What things do we own, or, you know, what does Pat own or co-own? Then, you know, when you're looking at, you know, his huge kind of library, his archive of material, it was like, okay, well, what can we do with this? We couldn't. We could have tried, I think, to create a graphic novel from Read 'em and Weep, maybe, but that would be a mammoth task, and very difficult creatively to get right, very very challenging, a very ambitious project, shall we say. So it just seemed very natural to say, okay, well, you know, this is a great story. Why, you know, this is crying out to be novelized.
Yeah.
And therefore, of course, you know, Amazon is the obvious one there. I mean, to be fair, we did actually publish it on multiple platforms. You know, we used on Kobo,
right,
and we're on Barnes and Noble site and various others. I mean, many others. But it just wasn't really being picked up, so I decided to pull that and just put it into Amazon's exclusive program for a while.
Yes.
You can do 3 months at a time, see how it goes, and you get people just who are in the Kindle Unlimited program, and they can read the book for free, and then the publisher gets paid for page reads. So that's just interesting to see how that goes, but that's not necessarily permanent.
Because I know when you log on to buy any of your books on Amazon, it asks you if you want to join that scheme, doesn't it? I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think they're always trying to push it.
The world of prose is such a different kind of world, isn't it? So, how has the experience been for both of you, knowing all this the comics world so well, and then stepping into the world of novels and, you know, biographies and that kind of? How has it been?
Well, from my point of view, not as daunting as I thought it would be.
Right.
I mean, I suppose because, maybe all of us start off writing prose and then we kind of end up writing comics or whatever.
Yeah.
So it was really like stepping back into my youth in a way, and just picking up where I left off. It's unfortunate in a way, but I think it's actually so much easier because as the book Be Pure makes clear, and I think I've been quite gentle on the subject and used a lot of anonymous names as well, but a lot of artists are very high maintenance. That's a very gentle way of putting it.
I have to put up with two every week, Pat. I completely agree with you.
I don't have high maintenance artists to deal with. I mean, you know, I mean, that's, you know, I probably shouldn't go on about that too long, because the last time I made a crack in that direction was at a Guardian masterclass, where I said to the assembled group something about, I mentioned this card, these cards that a Marvel editor had made for me, which said, Pat Mills, artist therapy, always available. And I kind of cracked this as a joke. It went down like a lead balloon. So
I think there were a lot of artists in the audience.
I think they were nearly all artists. So, yeah, they didn't seem to appreciate that very much. So I think from my point of view, you know, I mean, you see, it's not, this is one of the points I make clear in Be Pure, is it's the high maintenance factor is made worse because the money is so poor now. So everybody is always, you know, that creates stress. And so what it means is that some artists will go off and do something else, or they're going to cut corners, which will perhaps bring them into collision with me. Or there's going to be some other negative effect. You know, so a way I've had of dealing with high maintenance artists over the years, suddenly it's become not very cost effective, you know, where you actually have to think, oh, God, can I really deal with this? So for me, it's been a liberation. Lisa, what's your experience?
I think very similar. It's I mean, not all artists are high maintenance. Oh, don't move it. Patrick's just trying to fiddle around with the iPad here. Sorry about that. I'm just gonna plug in the power because we might be getting a bit low. There we go.
Okay, mate.
How's that?
That's okay. Yeah, good.
All right, good. Okay, jolly good. It's also just that sometimes, I mean, because I think possibly tying in with the fact that, you know, the wages don't go up, so artists are really you know, struggling as well, perhaps, you know, they have to do other jobs, and so there's a lot of waiting around for them to be able to fit the job in. And that's really frustrating, because you can go off the boil, or, you know, you want to get something done, you come up with an idea, you know, Pat writes the story, and then, you know, you're waiting years for something to come out, and you can't really work like that. Not you can't sustain that. So the great thing about you know, deciding to you know, to, you have an idea and you want to publish it, you want to do a prose novel or non-fiction, is it's done. You know, we decided to definitely. Do Be Pure this year, and you know, I edited. And, you know, we found the cover artist, and we got it published. And when did we start on that? Was that back in early May?
And we started writing? And we're thinking about it in March, weren't we? In March or April.
Yeah.
That's a very quick turnaround for, like...
Isn't it? And it's been out 6 weeks, so...
And that's how comics used to be done. I mean, that's the thing, that there was a kind of an immediate energy about it, whereas... again, it's the point I make, is that some stories, that Grey Suit's a case in point. I think it's taken nearly up to 3 years to actually come out.
This week, didn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a heck of a long period of time. And I like the dynamic energy that used to be there where comics are concerned. And I think in a way, the idea of, what can we write next? I'm currently writing volume two of the Read 'em and Weep series, Good Night, John Boy. But after that's complete, it's like, what should we do next? And there's so many candidates, really.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that second volume, especially after how it ended. Yeah, can't wait to read that.
And it ends on a very nice cliffhanger, and I'm just still at that frustrating stage of the novel where the correct thing to do is you plan out everything before you actually write, and that's how you're meant to do things. And it can be very frustrating because you think, God, this is going to take me another week.
Yeah.
But because, you know, so for example, I have someone quoting a poem. And so, you know, you, rather than when I'm writing to find the relevant poem, you find it in advance, you slot it in. So you've got this quite complex outline of all the characters and how the thing paces and so on. And then you go over it again, and then you do a kind of what I hope will be a three-page summary. And, yeah. And you know, the natural instinct I think we all have when we write is just sit down and get going. But I believe the rule is writing from the inside out rather than from the outside in.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, there's no absolute rules. I mean, you'll always find people who can make either way work. But anyway, I'm playing this by the rules this time.
The thing is, even like when you're writing characters, you know, even if you've got something planned out, you could just enjoy writing a character so much that it almost that goes off in a direction that you didn't expect. You know, so
there's a risk on that, and particularly with the main character in Serial Killer, because he's such an interesting character. One of the ways that there's nothing unique about this, I think this is a standard solution, certainly in indie publishing, whereby when you find you've got he could do this and that, and he does do this and that and the other, and you realize it's not actually relevant to the central plot. So what you do is you write that as a bonus story, you know, you kind of give away or use for marketing purposes or something. And so in the case of book two of Read 'Em and Weep, there are currently two extra stories, because I know if I put them in the body of the novel, it's a bit of a meander. It's going off the central point.
So you're kind of getting it out of your system so it doesn't detract from the main story.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, when it's a really good little story and it's funny and it's fun and it's really entertaining, it would be such a shame to lose it. But to follow, I think, you know, to keep a book fairly fast paced, well plotted, and with that really kind of forward momentum, that thrust. Yeah. That you want, you know, you kind of want that kind of page turning thing. I think it could. There's a risk of it sort of slightly diluting that, and so I think far better to still enjoy it, but to sort of have it as an extra and an external little independent story. And again, that comes back to that freedom of the choosing what to do when you self publish.
Yeah,
we can make those decisions, and we can turn on a sixpence and say, okay, what should we do with this? Let's do it that way instead. And we're not having to, you know, ask for anyone's opinion on that.
I mean, you imagine if a book was being published by Random House, you know, or you know, any mainstream publisher, and you said, oh, I'd like to add this bit to it or that bit, you know, it would end up going before a committee and this and that. I think we're not alone in recommending to everybody go indie. And I think I quoted to you, Tony, an example of an author we met who made a point of saying he's not a name. He's got out 7 books in kind of post-apocalypse series, and he's making a good living at it. And that's within 2 years of starting up. So I think that's encouraging to people, because, you know, one of the frustrations for me is quite a lot of writers and artists who want to work for 2000 AD, and they send me stuff and say, well, what do you think? Do you think I could, you know, get into the comic? And I try and steer them away. Unless they have a house style. If they have a house style, you know, in other words, if they look like McMahon or Jock or someone like that, then they've probably got a good chance. But if they're a little maverick, not so. And occasionally writers come my way as well. And, you know, I try and encourage them to go for the indie market, because... conventional publishing it has become very conservative, I feel.
You've said that to me. We talked through a project. In fact, I showed you some pages from it, and I think you said, have you thought about, you know, self-publishing? It seems to be the easiest route, you know, and I think you're right, and it's something we have decided to do. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I think sooner or later, someone, perhaps on Comixology, let's say, will have some kind of hit as an indie.
Definitely.
And when that happens, that will be when everybody will be going down that road. I mean, at the moment, Requiem is working for us as on Comixology, but. You know, the artwork was still originated and paid for, and the script was originated and paid for on paper. But if someone sooner or later goes down either the Comixology road or one or two of those American sites that are coming out with material, and when that really starts making money for people, and sooner or later that someone's got to do... What should we say? I don't know, the equivalent of Watchmen, you know, something that perhaps shows some new light on fantasy characters. Yeah. And when that happens, I think we'll all be at it. Yeah.
It'll be the same way that Twilight turned around that sort of fiction. You know, something will happen on Comixology. You know, something will spark up amongst younger readers, I like to think, you know. And it would just suddenly take off, I think. Yeah. I think you're right. I could see that happening any day.
It would be great if that happened. It would be so good because, I'm aware, for instance, of, you know, the YA audience, which is very successful. And you see all those kind of text stories that were once typical girls' comic stories. The kind of equivalent of the Hunger Games and so on.
Yeah, very much so.
I'd really like to see this market come back into
that could be a Misty story, couldn't it? The Hunger Games could have been a Misty story easily, couldn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Or indeed a Jinty story. Mavis Miller used to sort of specialize in science fiction stories as well. So, yeah, I mean, it has huge potential. So, you know, that's encouraging for the future. Absolutely.
But Pat, just before we jump in, I know Vince has got a couple of reader questions, listener questions, haven't you, Vince? I think
I have indeed.
I just wanted to ask one more area I'd just like to cover, because I think people will be interested in it. It's certainly something I'm really interested in, so I don't care what anyone else thinks. is Accident Man. Now, Accident Man is post production. It's done now, isn't it? It's in the can, ready to come out as a movie.
Yeah,
is that right?
And I think that there's the star, Scott Adkins, has put up a number of images from the film, a number of stills on
his Instagram account. Yes. He's got it's not his own one. He's probably put something up there, but I think he's set up, and I think it's Accident Man, the movie, I think maybe the name of the...
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a series of stills. Looks pretty good.
So that's really encouraging. I keep meaning to. I must write to him and find out. I'm assuming that there isn't a firm release date yet, but I imagine that must be around the corner. Yeah,
I know. I saw an interview with him where he said, at the moment, it's looking like a pay-per-view kind of release, but he would love, as would I, and everyone who's read Action Man would like a cinema. It'll be a brief cinema release. Would be great to see. I'd love to see it on the big screen. Some of the names, it's like a who's who of martial arts movie stars at the moment, isn't it? You know, looking amazing.
You mentioned that there's a lot of he's got a lot of support there from some quite famous names. So it should be good, I think. And in fact, in the back of my mind, still sort of kicking it around with my co-author on Accident Man, Tony Skinner, that the possibility of perhaps novelizing those or maybe originating some new Accident Man stories.
I'd love to see that, absolutely love to see it.
So would I, man. Because there's this whole tradition of novel assassin stories. And Accident Man, there's so many areas where, you know, he could be doing stuff. And So I don't know. I mean, we'd have to talk to Scott about that and see how he felt about it. But I mean, that's a possibility of starting something there, because I mean, there's a long tradition in pulps of these things like, I don't know if you remember Don Pendleton's The Executioner.
Mac Bolan, yes. I've got a pile of them in front of me. Yeah, brilliant stuff.
Right. And they're still going. I believe they do about four a year.
They do, yep. Yeah.
I mean, I think these authors must be a bit more prolific than I am. But who knows? I mean, I've got to master this whole dictaphone.
That'll speed you up.
Well, and speaking of which, you've done an audio book which is due release as well for BPO, haven't you? That's any moment, isn't it?
Yeah. What's the date on that?
I think it's cited for the 1st of August. A little bit earlier than we expected. Real. So Neil Gardner at Spoken World Audio has done a fantastic job of editing and mastering that. And I don't know if people have seen it, but there's a trailer that he's put up that's doing the rounds on the internet at the moment, so you can catch a bit of Pat.
How are we going to get that, Lise? Where's it going to be available? Do you know?
So it's going to be available initially just on the Spoken World store. So right. If you just Google Spoken World Audio, I think the domain is maybe .biz rather than the standard ones. Yeah. But Neil has he's got a whole storefront on his site. It's going to be exclusive to Spoken World Audio for, I'm not sure, a couple of months maybe.
Okay.
And then we're going to go and put it on Amazon as well, so it will be available through the Amazon channel, which I think is Audible.
Audible, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's spokenworldaudio.biz. Yeah. BIZ. Yeah, absolutely.
We'll put a link.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
And it's a nice segue to the listener questions, because we had a listener at Comics Art Fest Pod, which is the podcast of the Lakes, isn't it?
I think you were on recently, Pat, weren't you?
I was indeed, yes.
Yes.
So they're speaking to you again, and they asked, how did you find recording the audiobook?
It's quite tough, actually. We did it over 3 days, so you're working quite long sort of office hours, 9 till 6, say, with an hour off for lunch. And it is quite something. And after a while, you find your voice going a little bit. But then, of course, the other thing about it is that when you're going through that experience, you keep wanting to change things, because some things read okay in text. When you read them aloud, you think, Christ, that's a really clumsy sentence. And you have to make changes there. And then the other thing, again, it's coming back to, if you think about it, it's covering 40 years of my life, and you're reading it out in 3 days. So it is like your whole life is going flashing. Did you want to cry?
Did you want to cry at some time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you find yourself, there's obviously a measured overall style to the thing, but you find yourself delivering some lines with more passion than others, shall we say.
That's why people want to hear you doing it, Pat. Yeah. That's the reason. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a monotone.
Do you have to?
I think that's the one thing you can be guaranteed. It's
Did you have to hold back from any expletives, adding any curse words occasionally?
I think I did on occasion. There was
because there are some in there already. Oh, yeah. I think you've written a few in.
Yeah.
Did you want to add a few more as you?
Yeah, but I mean, there's nothing like for fuck's sake or something like that. I think
nothing like that.
Yeah, I think that's because Lisa's as my editor on all these things. So she would have deleted
some bits. No, but I mean, it's a very conversational tone, isn't it? So you want it to be your voice. It's got to be authentic, and there's no problem certainly with swear words in fiction. Thank God.
Yeah,
like in real life.
Thank fucking.
Yeah. Thank fuck.
You know.
Yeah.
We all like swearing very much.
Yeah.
We do.
Yeah, we do.
Line of intelligence.
Did you also have to, like, you know, you couldn't have like cups of tea with milk or something like that? Was there those sort of things that you
same,
had to?
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. There's some fairly strict rules on all this. He sort of said in advance that I had to have porridge for breakfast.
Right.
Really? And then he didn't recommend tea made with milk. So when I was in his studio, you know, he opened up this awesome collection of herbal teas. You know?
Oh yeah, where are we going with
vast,
this?
Fast array of them. He really made a point of all those things. Obviously, because he's aware of, you know, he must have had quite a lot of speakers who, you know, hit problems for
yeah,
whatever
I think,
reason.
I think, I mean, I was sort of genning up on it in advance, and I read that, you know, you want to avoid your, you know, getting tummy rumbles, because that really comes through very loud on the mic. So, and then obviously the milk is kind of mucus forming, so you get a bit claggy, and you want to be really clear. Oh, and also, I don't know if you did this, but one of the recommendations I read was to do some warm-up exercises and kind of, you know, run through some tongue twisters, you know, Peter Piper, pickled peppers, that sort of thing. But I guess you didn't do that. You were just like, morning, should we get started?
No. We started with a general rant about...
Vince makes me do that before
life,
the show.
Life in publishing, and I think Neil's experience in the world of audio roughly corresponded to my experience in the world of comics. So I think we had a good
juices flowing.
Yeah, we had a good 50 minutes rant about our you know, various people to be avoided, like the plague and all that kind of stuff.
You should do the tea version, and then the later on you should do the Scotch version. We just drink a lot of Scotch and then get on it. Yeah, that'd be good.
That's a good point, actually. I should have asked him that there might be something in that point at which just before you become completely inebriated, where you are actually, you know,
you
things are really flowing.
Well, you could always offer it as a bonus chapter, like you've done with the other books. So.
That's a good idea.
We could call it the Scotch tapes.
Oh. Right itself.
Oh. That's mine, that is. Don't steal that.
Right. Okay, next question. Tom Curry at This Chucklehead. He said, what excites you in terms of comics these days? Are there any titles that you are following?
I think, to my shame, I'm not following any at the moment. I really should. I'm sure there's something brilliant out there that I, you know, really should be looking at. But I mean, unfortunately, what's the one that you, Lisa swears by one particular, it's a digital one with a female lead.
Oh, you're talking about Saga?
Saga,
I do really enjoy that, yeah. There's another one that I've got the first couple of editions, and I would like to shove it under Pat's nose at some point, and that's Bitch Planet.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's not necessarily new at the moment, is it? And also, I only just discovered Alex Ronald's Vampire Vixens. Was it Vampire Vixens? Nazi Vampire Vixens or something?
That sounds good.
stunning in its bad taste and beauty, really. It was just gobsmackingly.
Why do we not know about this, Vince? This
is gross.
That's a one-off that he did. Probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. It has an introduction by Mark Miller, and it has that same kind of computer orientation that Clint Langley's art has. But it's in wonderful bad taste, and of course, I think so. He was the natural artist for the cover of Be Pure.
Oh, brilliant!
And indeed, he did the cover of Grey Suit for 2000 AD, the South American adventure.
Yeah.
And I think he does the I think he did the cover for the final episode of Grey Suit as well. I think he's a fantastic artist. So
I'd say Grey Suit this week killed. I absolutely loved it this week. I don't know if you follow me on, if anyone follows me on Twitter. So we put in some panels up. I absolutely loved it. I can't wait to see where that goes. Top stuff.
I think it's one of the darkest stories I've written, because there was this long delay between the last series and this one. According to Matt, it had lost some momentum with the readers. So this is sadly the final one. And I would dispute that conclusion. I'm sure if it was in a galaxy far, far away, it wouldn't have been that sudden death, which I think happens to stories set in a modern reality. So I think I demonstrate in this story just what they're missing. That's fair enough. All that kind of energy I shall use on an Accident Man text novel or something else. Rebellion's Lost. But I am quite bitter about it, and I think some of that bitterness is reflected in the character of Grey Suit and what he gets up to with, with some of his targets. Yeah. So, as always, you draw on your own feelings to create a strong story.
Yeah,
I think the finest is particularly strong.
Thank goodness Pat isn't a psychopath, the inventive revenge he would wreak.
He puts it all down on paper so people on the streets
are
safe.
Yes, and we're all the safer for it.
Yeah. Well, as Pat knows, I've got plans for my retirement, so I might be knocking on his door for that. That's fine. Yeah.
Right, next one. This is going to be interesting. Daniel Banks, at underscore Daniel Banks, he says, "You've surely got to ask why he isn't involved in the new Scream / Misty special. He's been trying to get Misty back forever." Now, do you know about this, Pat?
And in fact, I put something up on Facebook about this, and then I thought, well, you know, one of my survival techniques is to step back from these things before I go into major rant mode. But I'll highlight, my understanding of it is that a Scream Misty special, and that there is an equal content within it. Mm. In other words, there are Scream stories and there are Misty stories, and the Misty stories are written by female writers, and that's great. But the thing, and the only thing I took exception to, and I really, I mean, just thinking about it makes me seethe, is that the cover is superb. It's one of the best covers I've ever seen. In it's by Henry Flint, and it features a corpse in the best tradition of Weird and Eerie, reading, I think, copies of Misty and so on, and there's probably some great symbolism in there that I've missed as well. it's a fantastic cover, and then they ruin it. They absolutely ruin it by having screen. Why can't I say that word? Imagine what I was like on this on this audio book. Scream in really big letters, and Misty as a poor relation on it, and Misty's in small letters alongside it. And you know, now you imagine, for example, if it was something like say it was a Star Lord and 2000 AD special, and 2000 AD was in small lettering. I think fans would be quite cross. And I was appalled by it, and I think it's probably subconscious sexism rather than anything deliberate. But there is this tendency, and I really felt I needed to say something, that, you know, you often see when people are talking about Misty, it's, I used to read my sister's comic, Misty, and I loved it. And that's superb. I mean, God, we need all the readers we can get. But, you know, it was missing out on what I would call that female energy. And, I mean, even within Misty itself, there are certain stories that have what I would call specifically female energy. And one of them is Moonchild. And I would say the Sentinels, for example, coming up in the second round, because it's a concept story, first of all, it has more kind of male energy, if you like. And
that's not to say that females, women wouldn't like that story, though, is it? That's
not at all. But it's if you have character stories that are, you know, with a strong sort of female character as the center of the thing, you know, that will tend to appeal more to a female audience than a male audience. But I think, I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but my feeling when I saw it with Misty just tagged in as a desperately poor relation.
Well, yeah, I felt that, you know, it's not just your point of view here. So perhaps I might say I may be representative of other readers as well. It's just my first thought on seeing the cover was, yeah, it's a great cover, but why is Misty just tagged on as an afterthought? And I just, and then, you know, the response is, oh no, it's equal inside, and that's great. Okay, so there's going to be equal content. Then why have it like that on the cover? And
yeah,
it's just an unfortunate slip, I think. It's almost a kind of Freudian slip.
Okay.
They don't realise they're doing it, maybe.
Because I know Misty's got a huge amount of momentum at the moment. Misty is like, everyone's talking about Misty. I heard Jonathan Ross on the Radio 4 Art Show podcast the other day talking about it. You know.
Well, that's the thing. And I also felt a little aggrieved because I can't remember exactly how long Scream lasted, but it was far less than Misty. Misty was, you know, was an A-list comic, and Scream wasn't. And therefore, it really was, I thought, a lack of respect for Misty and certainly its original readers. When it comes to myself, well, I'm so used to Rebellion's lack of respect there. There's nothing new for me where that's concerned. So it didn't surprise me that they have the courtesy to consult me, because I would have happily given them any kind of insight. Well, you know, if there were particular things that they were interested in, because after all, you know, there's quite a canon on Misty, and there's, as I say, this thing, for instance, about potential blokiness is there, and even in the original Misty, there were certain stories where I think, oh, for God's sake, why have you got those stories in? Because you know instantly from looking at them, they're also Rands. In many respects, I think it's fair to say, with girls' comics or a female audience, it's much easier to figure out when you've got it right and wrong. For a male science fiction audience, it's tougher.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay, that's interesting.
There you go.
Yeah.
Now, I think this is a nice question to finish off with. Chris Baker from Dead Canary Comics, at CS Baker Comics. He says, what place in pop culture does the comics medium have now? It's quite an essay question, that one.
Yeah,
isn't it?
That's
wow.
A good one, isn't it?
Yeah.
That is a good one. I mean, this is the industry in general, rather than 2000 AD in particular, isn't it? I suppose.
Yeah.
So,
maybe.
Obviously, movies are really overshadowing them, and probably not necessarily to their advantage. But I think the main thing is that everybody has kind of been marinated with. Their comic strip background as kids, perhaps in a way. I mean, it's always been the case. So you've got guys in their 70s and more who, you know, grew up on Dandare and Eagle and so on. But I think it's much bigger now. I think it's much more widely accepted. And I think it's, it's encouraging. I mean, it's not at its high water mark as I think it once was. I mean, thinking of Britain, where, yeah. I mean, there used to be a time, probably, what was it, the 80s, where 2000 AD was very much part of pop culture, almost to its detriment, because you had New Musical Express were reviewing the comic, and the Thargs at the time were actually taking their views seriously and thinking, oh, okay, we need to be a bit more cool, we need to be a bit more hip, whatever. So I think there is that danger with pop culture. But I think for the most part, you know, it's really nice to think of, headlines will come up every so often when there's some awful, thing happening in politics, and they say, oh, are we heading for a Judge Dredd state? You know, so it's great that that's happened. And it takes me back to, when I started 2000 AD, that I felt Lichtenstein, I mean, if anyone sums up pop culture, it's got to be those Lichtenstein images, hasn't it? Oh, Brad, and all those kind of things. And so I desperately wanted 2000 AD to have Lichtenstein style covers. And as I describe in the book, my art editor, who was very, really talented guy, Doug Church, but very old school, describing Lichtenstein and saying, well, I want all these red dots, on the faces and everything. He's just looking at me like, what the fuck is the matter with this guy? So in a way, I wanted 2000 AD to have that pop culture representation of Lichtenstein, and I couldn't get it because I couldn't describe it to the art editor, and the book had been nicked and so on. So I finally managed to get that pop culture look on the cover of Be Pure, Be Vigilant, Behave.
Yeah, that's a great image as well. The cover's very striking. Yeah. We were chatting about that in the week, weren't we, Vince? And you were saying it's definitely going to pop on the shelf and that. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It is lovely, and that's down to Lisa and the artist, is it Alex Ronald? Where he got the idea instantly, and so an earlier abortive version. For a while, we thought, oh God, maybe we're asking too much of the artist, but then Lisa talked to Alex and
a lucky meeting at Glasgow Comic Con. Well, in the pub afterwards, of course, goes down. So yeah, that was a really good meeting, and that was basically his first attempt. I mean, it was so smooth. A couple of minor adjustments on the lettering, but also just a word about the lettering is that because the brief, which was very much from Pat, was, you know, that we wanted that kind of big bash lettering, that really lively, dynamic lettering of the original hand lettering comics. What Alex did there was he actually went back and took the lettering from things like Laugh This Off, Twinkle Toes, and
you better explain what that is.
That's from Savage, and that is that was the hand letter by, is it Jack Potter? Alex went and looked at that original hand lettering, and I don't know if it was all taken from that one episode or what, but he managed to source all of the letters that he needed, and he used them, and then of course he had to kind of just sort of render on top of them to make them, you know, sharp and everything. But so the reason that the dynamic quality of the book cover is because it's actually Jack Potter's lettering. Alex has taken it and obviously used it for the title and the subtitle and everything. And that's why it kind of like jumps off the page at you.
You can't fake that stuff, can you? I think, you know.
No, and you see, it's not completely straight. If you try to letter that between ruled lines, you lose that lively quality. And of course, the Pat Mills, the author lettering is Alex just very faithfully copying the word brat-a-tat-tat from a famous Lichtenstein poster. So we said we wanted to look exactly like that. And he got it. He did it first time. And so we're just really pleased because I think it does actually almost look like an authentic Lichtenstein. It's got that kind of cheeky dynamic quality.
I think it was great to show because one of the it was a lecturer at Dundee, Duncan O'Gordonston,
Phil Vaughan,
who brought up with me. He said, "Why isn't there hand lettering anymore in comics?" And I suppose you get ground down over the years by the suits and think, oh, well, maybe it's not possible anymore. But you suddenly realise when you look at those early issues of 2000 AD that there's a third creator on them, and that is the hand letterer. In other words, the words, often, they're not particularly good, but in the hands of a great hand letterer like Jack Potter, suddenly they're really dynamic. And there's no way on the kind of money that the computerized hand lettering done today is that they can produce that kind of flavor. It's not a criticism of today's letterers. It's just simply they're not paid that kind of money. Whereas I think it was normal in the past to pay hand letterers relatively good money, and that's why I think we all of us remember some of those fantastic slogans. And it's not just the words. So the one that comes to mind, obviously, is Bill Savage saying, "Laugh this off, Twinkle Toes." But there's probably others like "Gaze into the face of dread." So it's not just the great words. It's not just the great art. It's the actual lettering itself. And I'd really like to see a return to this. If it can't be done on the interiors, maybe it can be done more on the covers of 2000 AD. I mean, maybe they do, but I can't think of an example off the top of my head. I'm sure there must be some.
Word balloons are few and far between on covers these days, aren't they?
Yeah, and you see, that's what I really wanted. It's reminded me that that's why I wanted that Lichtenstein thing, is I wanted really good slogans. Now, of course, that's a hell of a discipline. It means you've got to be pretty witty, which, of course, none of us are, not all the time. But I really wanted to back myself into a corner so that every week we had to say something really sharp, "Laugh this off, Twinkle Toes," or "Gaze into the face of dread." And, of course, it can be done because you look at Private Eye, which for many years they had these wonderful balloons. And so I always thought that was it was a bit of a setback. And when I couldn't get that, I was reaching out a number of directions, one of which I think was a good direction. I never see it mentioned, which is why I'm giving it a plug now.
Okay.
I said to Brian Bolland at the time, come up with some cover, you just know this guy as a megastar right from the first time you see his work. So I said, do you want to do some covers for 2000 AD? So he came up with about, from memory, about six, and we just wrote some story around them. But I think those six covers must be amongst some of the most memorable. I rarely see them actually on Facebook or elsewhere. And there was one that I remember turning down, and I looking back on it, I think it probably was the right thing to do, but I still regret it. If I describe it to you, you'll understand why I turned it down. There's a very innocent little girl walking along the pavement, rendered as only Brian could, and in the gutter, beneath a drain, is some horrible ghoul looking up at her. with a very unpleasant expression on his face. I thought, no.
Yeah, leave that one for the moment.
I think we might have a problem with that one. But, I mean, I'm such a fan of Brian's. He could almost do anything, and I'd say, oh, yeah, that's fine. But I thought, Damn, I wish we could have run that. I imagine he's got it. He's probably featured that
sold
somewhere.
Sold in the thousands by now, Pat, hasn't he? We both know that,
Probably made a few quid on it, Well, Pat and Lisa, you've been absolutely brilliant.
That's been brilliant.
As always. This won't be the last time they'll be invited on. Don't worry, listeners. For those people who want to pick up the latest books, where can they get Be Pure and Serial Killer, etc.?
Pass you over to Lisa there.
Yeah, just head over to Amazon and you can pick up the ebook or the paperback. And then, of course, the audiobook of Be Pure will be available from the 1st of August at spokenworldaudio.biz.
Great.
Brilliant.
Excellent. Yes, yeah. Amazing.
Follow Greysuit as well. Greysuit 2000 AD at the moment.
But let's not forget Requiem. Requiem volumes 1-9 are up on Comixology, and volume 10 will be available from the 2nd of August.
Real.
That's my done.
That is a book that each book will take you a week to read. There's so much to it. It's so well written and so beautiful. Great stuff. Incredible.
So thank you again for joining us. It's been amazing.
It has.
Cheers, guys.
Thanks,
guys.
Thanks. Bye.
Crumbs. Wasn't that amazing?
It was good, wasn't it?
It was
cracking. How good was that?
It was cracking.
I cannot wait to see that new movie, the Accident Man movie, and I can't wait to play Pat on reading his book out in the car. It's going to be absolutely brilliant, isn't it? How good is that going to be?
I'm a big fan of audiobooks. I listen to quite a lot, so that's definitely going in the pot, I think.
And nobody should ever be allowed to read that book out loud apart from Pat. Because I think we had quite a few people write in saying, you hear him as you're reading the text page. Never mind, you know, it's going to be brilliant. Yeah, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, so thank you once again, Pat and Lisa, for joining us.
We
have threatened that Lisa was so good she might come onto a show by herself.
Yeah. But she's gone for a lay down, she told us.
Yeah, she says she's retiring from the podcast game after that.
Dropped the mic and gone for a lay down.
Yeah. but have we got any shout outs, Tony? You got a couple of shout outs this week, haven't you?
I have a couple, yes. I've got The Human Beings, issue 3, just gone up on Kickstarter. Of course Stuart has hit his mark within about 6 hours. But there's some excellent further rewards coming with each stretch goal, so go and have a look at that, Human Beings on Kickstarter. I meant to say this last week, because I had some technical difficulties. I'd just like to say that I got sent a preview copy of The Impossible, which is written by Chris Sides, art by Jake Rowlinson, and colours by Daniel Franco, out of Marcosia. Fuck me, this book is... I have to say, in a small press world, this book is next level stuff. I've got to tell you, this could be... I won't give the plot away, because I'll give it a proper preview and a review in a few weeks, but this could easily be an Image book. Chris and Jake have just killed it on this book. Brilliant stuff. Excellent. And my third one is Chunks, issue 3, came out this week as well. After Matt spent his day taking the piss out of Vince, of course I had to review it the other day in Swindon. And we had a great time with Matt, and anyone who knows Matt Garvey knows how enthusiastic he is about the medium, and it is brilliant, well worth a read. If you go to neverwriteanything.blogspot.co.uk, you can see I'll put a review up this week, and the links are there to go and buy a copy. Go over there you go.
Splendid. There's not really much else we need to talk about other than the recommendations, isn't there, Tony? I mean, we've already given you enough, so you should be grateful.
Yeah, you probably won't get rid of us by now, don't you?
By now you've probably stopped the podcast and gotten on with your life. But if you are still listening, thank you. Here's some books that you should check out in the near future. Tony, take it away.
I'm going to go with a book that we got sent, I'm going to say around a month ago, by Stash Comics, who's an American company. I think, is that right, Vince? I think they're American, aren't they?
Yeah.
The link came through to you, didn't it?
Yeah.
A book called Primas, P-R-I-M-A-S, Primus or Primus. And it's created by Alberto Pessoa. This is a translation that Stash Comics have put out. It's actually based on a study of research by somebody called Garcia from the Federal University of Paraiba, which I think is a Brazilian place, on prostitution in their country. And it's based on this sort of academic study, and I believe on a number, if not one, true account of a woman who found herself falling into the game of prostitution and the horrible things that sort of ensue from that. It's absolutely incredible. We've both read it, haven't we? You've had a look at it, Vince, haven't you? It's just an incredible book. And it just shows the central wheel of the story is this one incident that happens to the female character in it. And a very violent encounter that happens. And the story flows into that moment of how she came to be there. And it flows out of that moment on how she sort of recovered and came to realise that, you know, that how life is and how she can pull herself out of this sort of hole that she'd gotten herself into. She's a woman who was married, and her husband, this is a quote I put in the review that I wrote, "My husband always told me, you depend on me for everything, you are nothing without me. So I told him to fuck off." And she walks out of the house, caught in a poverty trap, and is pulled into this life, which at the start feels almost glamorous, and men seemingly worship her and pay her money. And she works out of a bar run by a pimp character. But she throws into the mix there little moments where she says things like, "But I only cried that one night." So after the first encounter, she cries. And then a violent encounter happens. Something just horrific happens. And it's done with probably the biggest sort of realistic moment I've seen in comics for a long time, where, you know, suddenly out of nowhere comes this violent moment. And how she sort of lives her life out of it and how she recovers from the injuries and stuff like that. Beautiful, solid black lines, real strong inking style. Seemingly everything takes place at night. And if you go through to the back of the book, there, a lot of the venues are based on real places and real people and real moments that happen. And there's some photographs that are compared to the artwork. Really, really beautiful stuff. If you go to Stache Publishing, STACHE Publishing.com, or go to @Stache_comics on Twitter. I think it's about to be stuck up as a Kickstarter any moment now, I believe. Yeah. But keep your eyes out for it. Really, really great stuff. Incredible stuff. Very strong. Great stuff. Yeah. There you go.
Very, very strong indeed. Yeah.
Yeah.
My pick this week was one I picked up at the Swindon Comic Book Extravaganza that we were at the other day. I finally managed to pick up issue 3 and 4 of Mulp, Sector of the Sun, by Matt Gibbs and Sarah Dunkerton. Is it Sarah?
Sarah, I think.
Sarah.
I think it's Sarah Dunkerton. Isn't it?
Yeah. Please don't hit me next time you see me.
Please do.
Yeah, she will. You'll be seeing her soon anyway. And it's from Improper Books. It's an anthropomorphic comic book. I'm always pleased when I can say that properly. And it's a pulp adventure set in a world of mice. What more do you need? But I already had issue 1 and 2. It's a 5-issue series, so 5's on its way fairly soon. I think they might be releasing it later this year.
I think that is right. I think they were looking for Thought Bubble release.
It might be a Thought Bubble release. Yeah. And what a 5 issues this is going to be when it's all collected. It is something else, I must say. Sceptre of the Sun follows the exploits of Jack Redpath and Vicky Jones as they attempt to unravel a mystery surrounding an ancient stone tablet unearthed during an archaeological excavation in Egypt. It's a world travelling series in the true sort of like Indiana Jones / you know, around the world in 80 days kind of style. It's proper good adventure in a true pulpy style. It was a recommendation. I think I recommended 1 and 2.
I think you did, and then we had on the show after that, didn't we? I think
is
the way it works.
Yeah, we had Sarah on the show afterwards.
We need Matt on, actually. We really do need him. I keep saying to Matt we'd be up for any. I think he would be.
Yeah, it was my first time actually probably chatting to Matt at Swindon, and he's such a. I picked up another one of his books there. You know, such a great and knowledgeable writer.
Yeah, we properly bonded on our love of Dune. we're both big Herbert fans. There you go.
Brilliant. Yeah. Yes, we'll probably hear from him fairly soon, because after we spoke about Mulp 1 and 2, we got Sarah on. So I think it's only fitting. 3 and 4, let's get Matt on.
Yeah.
But it's such a great book. I mean, so well written. The characters are so well rounded, and the adventure and sort of the nature of where the adventure goes is just wonderful. And it is a series that with each issue, it just gets bigger and better. And obviously that shows in the artwork as well, because it is beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, the first issues are sort of like, there's a lot of setup, isn't there, and getting you into this world. But 3 and 4 have just some absolutely stunning sort of the big panels and splash pages where it's like just let the artwork sing. I mean, certainly at the end of issue 4 there's like a kite. I can only describe it as a kite. It's sort of made out, it's like a bird's skull, and there's feathers.
Oh, okay, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, yeah.
And there's a page where it's swooping over like this sort of Peruvian sort of like jungle and mountains and stuff, very Incan and like Mayan temples. But and just that one page, I could stare at that one page for ages. You can see the love and detail that goes into every character, from the words that come out of their mouths to their design. And the books, I always love this touch when there's a little like behind the scenes, you know, art sketches and stuff that go on in the back. And we've got Jenny Yildblad, she's in issue 4, she got a pin-up. Laura Trinder has a pin-up in issue 3.
Brilliant.
And there's wonderful sort of like, it's not just character sketches, you know, they look at like certain, there's an alphabet as well that's like an archaeological alphabet that they use. It's just fascinating, just loads of little details like that. So definitely if you see them at a show, pick up every issue of Malt that you can, because
anything by Improper Books, to be fair,
yeah, they
everything they do is gold, isn't it?
It is gold. And not only that, just the quality of the books, just the feel of it, and you know, care and attention to detail. So yeah, we love them. You can find out more about the comic at malpcomic.com. On their Twitter is at malpcomic. If you want to follow Matt, it's at Matthew Gibbs on Twitter, and Sarah is at Sarah Dunkerton. So can't recommend it enough, and I cannot wait for issue 5. So I've been meaning to get 3 and 4 for ages, so it's nice to get 2 issues to read. Do you know what I mean? I just absolutely devoured them. Amazing.
And if you meet him at con, she does a great little sketch in it for you as well. She did one for me. Really nice.
She sketched in both copies, which was lovely.
That's good.
Yeah, she didn't have to do that, but she's just a nice person. So there you go. Yeah. It's nice for someone to be nice to me occasionally.
Garvey, we need you back.
Yes, indeed. But thank you very much for listening, folks. It's been a cracking one.
Yeah.
And we'd love to know what you think about the show and upcoming shows and everything we've been doing. So get in touch. There's several different ways you can do it. You can email us awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. The jam piece is full, but I think we've got a few parking spaces left.
Have we?
So,
still some spaces left?
Yeah. So tony.awesomecomicspod@gmail.com to send your independent character that you would like to be part of a jam piece that is basically a collection of some of the best and brightest independent comic book characters out there, isn't there? It looks fantastic. Yeah. So, and
we've still got a few badges left.
Oh, yes.
Badges as well. How cool are we?
We are cool. We're like the coolest kids. Do you know what?
Really.
As I was saying each word, I thought, that's so uncool, Vince. Stop saying it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you want to be cool, follow us on Twitter at The Awesome Pod. I really need to stretch my segue muscles. I really feel like I've been out of the game. Do you know what I mean? I need to limber up before every show. There was a couple of times when Pat and Lisa were talking that I thought, oh, this could segue nice into, no, Vince, not now. It's not the right time. But it's always...
I can hear Lisa rolling her eyes going, what is he saying now?
I know.
She does that most of the times when I speak to her face-to-face. But rightly too. Yeah. Because if you've gone, funny you should mention a cup of coffee. I haven't got a cup of tea in front of me. We could do another one like that, can we? Yeah.
And if
let's have a whole conversation with a punter at London where we just do it all in segues and see if they spot.
That's brilliant. That's a brilliant idea. I'll tell you what else is a brilliant idea. You should us on facebook.com/awesomecomicspodcast. And if you're making comics and you just love comics and you actually just want to talk about comics and comics events, you know, a proper good conversation, then join our Facebook group, Awesome Comics Talk. Gav Mitchell said when I saw him in Swindon that it's more like a forum, and I didn't think about that.
It's been, I suppose, isn't it?
It's become like a forum for just decent comics talk.
I had a bit of a rant on there last night. I'm quite proud of.
Yeah, I live in fear of what Tony's going to post on there from day to day.
So, I sent you a picture, 2 pictures this week. Should I post them on there?
No, don't. You'll get arrested. Anyway, so I'll leave that up to the listener's imagination. Thank you for listening to us, as always, whether it's at the website awesomecomics.podbean.com. If you listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher or Podnose, please leave a review. It helps get the word out.
Please.
And we just want more people to enjoy the content like we got this week. You know.
Definitely.
You know. So thank you to everyone for listening. Where can people find us online, etc.? Tony?
If you go to Ezo, yes, E-Z-O-H-Y-Z. If you go to tinyletter.com/CockneyKungFu, please sign up to the mailer that me and Nick Prolix are doing at the moment. We are having an absolute blast doing it.
I've done a little bit with that as well.
Yeah, once a week, that's the thing. I've done a little bit of a history of where something in the story happens. And it's I'm quite pleased with it. It's sort of a little history of the sort of criminality of a certain area. So have a look at that this week. It's something a little bit different, and there's a sort of intro, and also Nick shows some of his art, some of the how he's doing the art he's producing for the story as well, which is out of this world stuff. Yeah, there you go.
Might be hearing from Nick Prolix.
Very soon. Mm. Yeah.
And you should also check out Vanguard, which is absolutely smashing. He may not be here, but we love him, and we love his comic
book. I'm seeing him later. I'll give him a hug.
All right, don't show up. Yeah. We'll give him a hug from me. Give him a kiss on the cheek.
Really?
Go on. Because I want to see that. I want to know that that's happened, and you made the whole room uncomfortable. But
I'll do that anyway.
You can follow Dan and his amazing artwork at Vanguard Comic on Twitter, and go to vanguardcomic.com, because it's worth it, and it's one of the best webcomics out there. End of. Don't worry, Dan, when you're back on one of the next shows, we'll be flipping horrible to you again. So, but until then,
obviously,
obviously, you can follow me at Jester Diablo, and you can find out more about my comic at theredmaskfrommars.com. So there you go. Drop the mic. It's another one in the bag, and I think it's been another cracking one. Can we keep up this kind of quality?
Well, we were going to talk about San Diego this week. Well, maybe we should shift it to next week.
Let's shift it to next week. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah.
Because we just had so much awesome content. Sometimes you just can't fit it in.
Yep. Very true.
Yeah. I was expecting some sort of dirty joke, but we're not going to have that.
Long and thin may go in, short and thick does the trick.
As always, he just can't help himself. Not one show will go by without some sort of crude comment.
Limerick.
You're a disgrace, but our listeners are lovely. So thank you for listening, folks. Have a brilliant week. Read loads of cool comics. And as always, stay awesome. See ya.